My name is Hedley Rees. I joined the industry, pharmaceutical industry in 1979 when I joined a US company called Miles Laboratories. It was taken over by Bayer, the German multinational, the following year. And whilst I was there, I started off as an industrial engineer working on improvement projects and ended up as head of the global supply chain for the company. And that site was fully integrated, producing pharmaceutical products from start to finish. And I gained a huge amount of experience there. Then I moved into Bayer.
Where was that? Where was that site?
In Bridgend in South Wales. It's actually closed down now, but they moved it to Poland. But while I was there, we used to make Alka-Seltzer for the whole of Europe. We made sterile injectables. We made a whole range of topical creams and ointments. It was the classic manufacturing and packaging plant that used to be around 40 years ago. So I left there, having done an MBA at Cranfield School of Management, and joined Biotech. I joined British Biotech as head of logistics. I was there 4 years, and when I joined, the share price was £24. It was bigger than Railtrack and WH Smith. And when I left, the share price was 15p, because basically they had scammed the world in saying they had a drug to cure cancer that they didn't have at all. So the company went belly up, and there was a big row in the Times between the CEO, Keith McCullough, and the head of clinical research, Andy Miller, which is quite infamous now. And to me, that was the first time I realized that investors can be scammed quite easily if you tell them you've got a drug that's going to work, and you sort of, you brief the analysts with pictures and evidence that isn't really evidence, then they will believe it and people will start investing.
Okay, so, cool. So someone on the inside there, can you tell us something about how that operated? Who was it within the business that knew this was a scam, and how did it manage to continue? Because there must have been some people that said, hang on a minute, this is a scam, even internally within the company.
Yeah, well, the chief executive was a guy called Keith McCullough, who interviewed me when I went there. I don't know whether he knew. He'd come from a big pharma company based in the UK, but certainly the finance director, James Noble, the R&D director, I forget his name now, and the commercial director, Ron Irwin, I think they knew what was going on. And and I would even say we used to have an annual day out, and they showed us once pictures of a cancer tumor being encapsulated by this new drug. And you know, that could not have been the case, because the drug was a complete failure. It failed to meet its endpoint. So, and those people are still in the industry, still of the same mindset that if you can fool people very easily in this industry, because no one really understands how it works. And
so,
what
am I right in thinking that you first realised this was a scam on this open day, or what? How did the penny drop for you?
Well, it dropped for everyone, because there was a second product called Zacutex for acute pancreatitis, where they actually submitted an application to the European Medicines Agency to market it, and it was turned down on the basis that they didn't think it was a good enough quality application. And that really knocked the whole competency or people's perspective of the competency of the company. And then the share price started to go down. And then this Andy Miller, the research director, unblinded the cancer study trials and said they weren't working. And he basically said, he implied that all the press releases were over-optimistic, and you know, some people are actually saying that they actually were untrue. It's, you know, if you go, if
so
you go
also, what about the press? Did the press get wind of this?
Or oh,
did
yeah,
they
just, there was a big
did they just repeat the press releases as they were given to them? Did they, were they able, this is one of the things that fascinates me when we see an announcement about some new drug. Are the journalists really up to the job to quizzing the drug developers as to whether the thing is a scam or not?
No, they haven't got a clue. They don't have a clue. None of them have been anywhere near a production plant or, you know, or the coal face of what's going on. And of course, there's, they have meetings at British Biotech. The analysts used to go out for dinner with the directors in Oxford. That, what's that name? That was the French restaurant fairly close by where it cost about 100 quid to have a, to have a dessert. You know, it was all going on, and they just do not understand, and the investors don't understand. They all think drugs just come out of the ground by accident and suddenly start to work. I've been saying this for years. In fact, I'm fed up of saying it.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the thing is that the journalists still do go for these things, hook, line and sinker, miracle drug discovered, this kind of thing, and shareholders get scammed. But anyway, we're chatting to you because it's 5 years since all this COVID stuff kicked off. If we think back to those days, first of all, I'll say many people, acquaintances of mine, and me myself had COVID, or what later proved to be a few months later, was in the news. But I had it back in December 2019. I heard from one of the producers up at BBC Bristol that on the 17th of December 2019, a camera crew came back from Switzerland who had this rather nasty flu, spread it around. And although it wasn't actually on the BBC news, that they were the people that brought this disease back to the West Country, and then as it went into the end of January, beginning of February, we had the more reports of the of this COVID thing happening in China, and the first people kind of on the case seemed to have been the New Delhi Institute of Virology, that had a whole brainstorming session and came up with a fascinating report which was not peer reviewed because they wanted it to get out all around the world, saying that this is unlikely to have occurred naturally pretty much straight away. And then we had announcements of lockdown. So can you just take us back to those days and tell us about, you know, what your thoughts are around what was going on 5 years ago?
Yeah, sure, Tony. Yeah. Well, I'm talking now with hindsight as well, but I mean, a lot of people believe there never was a virus. It was a PCR test that was run at 45 cycles per minute, which was going to find anyone who had a PCR test. It was going to find them positive.
I'd just like to say straight away, I definitely had something. I remember thinking at the time, this is around about Christmas 2019, God, if I was 10 years older, this could have killed me. It's a particularly ferocious flu, I assumed it was, but there definitely was a virus out there.
Well, yeah, but it's difficult to discuss these things because we don't know whether you had, I mean, lots of people have very bad experiences with flu, but you cannot make the, you know, the immediate assumption that it was connected with what was positioned as a global virus. But, you know, so it's a bit difficult to talk about that one, Tony. I know, obviously, if you had it, you had it. I'm not saying that you'd be lying. But if you look at the test and trace, the £37 billion test and trace thing that, I forget her name now, did, I mean, people were identified as having something called COVID based on a test. Even the guy who invented the test, the PCR test, Kurt Müller or something, he said you cannot use it to diagnose any disease. And when you run it at 45 cycles, you're going to find any little remnant of coronavirus in someone's body and they're going to be positive. Well, you know how many people were saying, oh, I've got COVID now. I've only had it a month ago and I've got it again. People were having it multiple times. But what they were doing was keep testing themselves. So, and
yeah,
I think
this is, okay, so let me just again intervene, because this is what is known as accelerationism. So you have something which is genuine, maybe like climate change, the climate is changing. And then what you do is you exaggerate it. So you have various methods to say that it's happening X, Y, and Z places where it isn't happening. So you have exaggeration, massive exaggeration, and then you have some kind of solution in the accelerationist philosophy. You have some sort of big solution, kind of inverted commas, which is spread around the press, the media in the whole world, or depending on which medias are gullible enough to spread it, which makes things worse. So anyway, just going back to Boris's decision, for example, to have lockdowns, what did you make of that?
Ah, complete nonsense, complete nonsense. The thing that stands out in my mind, Tony, I thought about this when leading up to chatting here, was that we used to have that nightly, daily briefing with Boris Johnson there and Chris Whitty at one side and Patrick Vallance at the other. And the person who stood out most for me was Jonathan Van Tam. You know, everyone's favorite uncle, you know, wall-to-wall Big Pharma. He's had Big Pharma running through his veins for many, many years. And he was coming out with these metaphors about, you know, about catching a train and a football match. And, you know, he was waxing lyrical on things that really were completely, all those metaphors didn't mean anything.
Well, yeah, but what he'll say to that is that you need to use humorous metaphors for people to understand. It's quite complicated science. This is a way of making it something that is easier to understand. Say, you're talking about, you know, catching a train, it might be that you're going from A to B and you're getting to a different station, a different stage in the virus or something. And these are ways of simplifying what is actually quite complicated science.
Well, one in particular where he read out a paracetamol leaflet with the side effects, saying all medicines have side effects. I would say the public listening to that, who didn't know the whole story, would be thinking, oh yeah, well, you know, this is a medicine, this vaccine, so it'll have some side effects. But, you know, Jonathan Van Tam said they've all got side effects, so just as well take one. And I forget the exact analogy, but I thought it was almost patronizing the way he was speaking. You know, there were very many intelligent people watching him, and those metaphors of a football match, score, it's nil all at half time, we haven't won yet, but blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, that's a little bit lowbrow for someone who's supposed to be the medical director of the UK or whatever. What's the medical? Whatever he was, anyway, or maybe assistant medical director. But, you know, and then you had Patrick Vallance, who was the VP of R&D for GlaxoSmithKline for a long, long time. The UK government was having meetings with the pharmaceutical industry every year from 2000. I've got the screenshots of the minutes and the agendas. So in 2000, they sort of got together. The people were, I got so many names in my head, but you had the CEO of Glaxo and the CEO of the Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry and the CEO of AstraZeneca meeting with high-level government ministers in 2000 saying, how can we help each other get up the ladder in life sciences? How can we become number one in the world? And the last meeting was in 2015, and in that you had Pascal Soirot, the CEO of AstraZeneca. You had Patrick Vallance. You had a whole list of people from the pharmaceutical industry who were basically discussing this whole thing. I've got all the evidence, it's, in fact, it's in the archives, it's in the government archive. It was called the Ministerial Industry Biopharmaceutical Strategy Group. And the minutes are quite shocking. And, so, you know, if anyone wants to see those, I can share those. But so what those briefings were from people who were absolutely vested in the pharmaceutical industry. Same with Kate Bingham. You know, she was a venture capitalist whose living was made off investing in pharmaceutical and biotech companies. And then you had Sir Richard Sykes, who I remember his name now, who was the CEO of Glaxo and Glaxo Welcome and chair of GlaxoSmithKline. He was the chair after Kate Bingham of the Vaccine Task Force. And working for him on that task force was Sir Ian McCubbin, who is now the chair of the Cell and Gene Therapy Catapult, whose mission in life is to get UK to the top in gene and cell therapies. You know, you sort of couldn't make it up, Tony, to be honest.
Well, what about Matt Hancock? I mean, we don't see very much from him these days. He was the sort of tough guy at the front, blazoning his way through, trying to make out that he understood all the science, etc., whereas he didn't really seem to have much depth to his knowledge. What do you make of Hancock? Because he's disappeared completely off the face of the earth now.
Well, it's not a surprise, is it? He's the guy who actually, he was the puppet, knowing nothing about what he was doing, who gave all the favors to his mates. I hosted a webinar of five people I knew just when this started on COVID. And one of the guys on there, he was referenced to me, was Alex Bourne. And I didn't know, told me he was an army captain, so I didn't know at the time, but it turns out he was Matt Hancock's pub landlord. And he said he had a £50 million contract to make the tubes and the caps for the PCR samples that were being shipped around the world. A £50 million contract. Now, I only found that out subsequently when I saw some newspaper articles about Matt Hancock's pub landlord. But he was given these things. But actually, he was placing orders himself with pharmaceutical companies, circumvented the whole infrastructure of distribution of drugs and ordering of drugs in the UK. It's all done through pharmacies ordering from wholesalers who then order from the pharmaceutical company. You can't order direct because there's no record of anything. There's no record of financial transactions. And I don't know how they did that, but, you know, it could not have been, in my estimation, I'm not an expert, but I can't see how that could have been legal, and I'd like someone to explain it to me.
Maybe it wasn't legal, hey? Maybe, in fact, much of what was going on was fraud. My own experience, of course, this period 5 years ago is when lots and lots of things were happening. So, for example, massive amounts of contracts were dished out to friends from the Conservative Party for contracts, particularly over personal protective equipment, which was seen to be there wasn't enough of it around. So that's PPE. My own experience, if I can share that, was where in Stroud, a neighbour of a friend. He was actually a very aggressive man when he first moved into the house. He was the only person in Stroud. It's quite a left-wing kind of place, Green or Labour mainly. In fact, it was a rural constituency that returned a Labour MP, and his was the only house in the whole of the town that had a Conservative sticker on the outside in the general elections. He was an extremely aggressive guy. You know, he'd come out of the house waving his fists around, threaten you, this sort of thing. His name is Steve Deccan, D-E-C-H-A-N. And he was part of a scandal to return millions after PPE revelations. I think it was the Daily Mail that put these out. And Stroud District Council Labour group leader Doina Cornell's called on him he received a £120 million contract to supply PPE. But one of the things I can tell you is that he was also master of one of the lowest numbered Masonic lodges in Stroud. So you do think, I mean, it just certainly looks to me as if the Conservative Party was, through its supporters, its members of the party, and particularly through its Freemasonry contracts, was giving out these contracts. So, yes, it's quite a lot, £120 million. But he then moved out of the house and bought a farm. This is the sort of thing that was going on. And I mentioned the Freemasonry because we very rarely hear that sort of thing talked about. And it could be simply that the Conservatives were trying to hide the fraud that they were dishing out contracts to their mates through the secret society. But anyway, he wasn't the only one by any means.
No, gosh. Yeah, so...
Anyway, back to you, Hedley. If you can take us back to the, I mean, particularly this decision to lock down. I mean, it was quite shocking, and many people have pointed out that again, money was involved. That the International Monetary Fund were also saying, well, in order to get these big payments, in order to from the IMF to cover all your expenses during the pandemic, you're going to have to do what we say, and that is to lock down.
Well, my observation is that in Wales, where I live, the First Minister was so keen to lock down, even lock down more than we were locked down. All the politicians just seemed to be determined to lock down no matter what, as if there'd been almost a global diktat that the whole world needs to lock down. And that's where, you know, from my side, pharmaceuticals, the pharmaceutical industry is global, and the UK is central to it because it's got a history in pharmaceuticals through Glaxo, which was number one in the world. Now it's number 10 and only just hanging on to that place, which is another story. But I think, you know, Bill Gates, was managing the whole global capture of regulatory authorities through, he employed the CEO of the MHRA in 2019, a chap called Ian Hudson. He went to work for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And 3 years before that, he'd helped set up a duplicate regulatory body with the WHO, called the International Coalition of Medicines Regulatory Authorities, self-elected, and they got all the regulatory authorities in the world, FDA, European Medicines Agency, MHRA, Anvisa in Brazil, to sign up to it. And undercover, they were hollowing out the regulatory authorities so that they were becoming increasingly more lenient on approving drugs. And if you remember, it was the MHRA that approved every single injection for COVID, Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca, and the rest of the world then went in lockstep. So the UK was the hub of the whole thing. And you know, Bill Gates was on speed dial terms with ministers, anyone in a position of power. So, you know, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was really pivotal. Gates employed a guy called Trevor Mundell in 2011, who was the former head of R&D for Novartis. Now, Novartis is the fourth biggest pharmaceutical company in the world, based in Switzerland. And, you know, Mundell was going around spreading the fact that there's pandemics coming and we've got to develop drugs for it and why we need these injections. You know, it was all a carefully laid out plan that really, as you know, was 10, 15, 20 years building until it came to the point where you know, they launched these injections.
In fact, I mean, they even had an exercise, didn't they, beforehand, trying it all out to see what would work and what might work and what might not.
Yeah, yeah. If I could say, Tony, one thing that people don't know is that the pharmaceutical industry, big pharma companies, were on the verge of bankruptcy if these products that they launched for rare blood diseases in 2017 were not a success. The first one was a Novartis drug called Kymriah. It was approved by FDA in September 2017 for rare blood cancers. And the supply chain itself is a complete nightmare. But 2 years later, there were unusual side effects occurring with these drugs. And not long after, FDA put a black box warning on them to say they cause neurological toxicities, cytokine storm, cytokine release syndrome, and secondary cancers. And now these drugs, as I say, were for rare blood cancers, roughly $400,000 for one treatment for one patient. And the first one that launched in 2017 is called Kymriah, K-Y-M-R-I-A-H. And if you look up the package insert that goes in with the product, if you look at the side effect warning, it's a black box warning from FDA. It's the highest warning you can get, which says, you know, you can expect to get one of those three, either secondary cancer.
Well, I mean, it sounds to me like it's saying rather than cure you, this could kill you. So it might be not such a good idea to take it. But I take what you're saying about the threats, the financial threats to big pharma, because I can remember a story, one of those things that just popped up and then disappeared forever, which was to do with the viability of big pharma, because there were all sorts of problems being discovered with the flu vaccine. So the idea is government is approving these flu vaccines, paying for them here in the UK through the National Health Service, encouraging everyone to have them. But it was becoming clearer and clearer year on year. And in 2019, it was completely obvious that the flu vaccine, you know, by the early 2019, the 2018-19 season, that it was totally ineffective, that really there was absolutely no point in people taking the flu vaccine. This also, once that's realised, it would have immediately affected the viability of the pharmaceutical industry, wouldn't it, and their credibility.
Yeah. Oh, that's exactly the point. You made the point there, Tony, because nearly every drug in the world is generic, is a copy of the original. Big Pharma, the only drugs that they've got patented are these drugs for rare blood cancers, which weren't selling, huge side effects, so they rebranded them as vaccines. They're both gene modified cell therapy using CRISPR technology, which is a way to insert DNA into a cell and then put that inside a patient on the principle that is going to cure a genetic disease or something. But, you know, no one knows when those things go in your body because of the DNA in them. No one knows what it's going to do to someone's body. And this is why they did the convert them to vaccines, because if they didn't, they'd have nothing to sell, because the ones for rare diseases weren't selling. So and.
Let me just also, sorry to interrupt you again, I keep interrupting, but Emmanuelle Charpentier, she runs the main CRISPR technology company. This is gene splice. The idea is that you can send in, I suppose you'd call it a nanobot or something, into a cell, which will go in, find the genetic material, and it's got these kind of chemical scissors that go in and snip, snip in the right places and changes the genetic makeup. Now, it might sound a bit sinister, but apparently there's a lot of money in this stuff. Now, she also just so happens to be a part of the Bilderberg conference. In fact, she's used at the Bilderberg conference. Certainly, I saw her. I actually was very close to her in 2016 in Dresden. in order to sell this technology to investors at the annual NATO countries sort of Fourth Reich powwow. At the time, it was with Henry Kissinger. So these people are extremely well connected with the funders too, and the funders are convinced, it seems to me, to put money into this technology, whether it works or not.
Yeah, well, again, that aligns with the British biotech example I mentioned. People think that drugs can... the supply chain is hugely complex. I use the penicillin example that I always use. People think that penicillin came to market through Alexander Fleming's discovery. It did, but that was only the first stage. Then it needed Oxford University to be able to tell Fleming how to manufacture small quantities that they could use for testing to prove that it was working. And they needed the US FDA to tell them what the process was, to design a process that could produce 10 quantities for the Second World War. It took 16 years to get penicillin to market. That's been documented by Bob Gaines in Germ Theory. But investors are thinking, oh, God, blimey, yeah, drugs come to market by accident. Oh, they've got this clever technology. Snip, snip. But if you look at a plant that makes... if you go past Swindon, you'll see a Catalent Pharma Solutions a site on the left-hand side where they make various packaging items. It's like a car plant, you know. It's heavy engineering, metal bashing. It's not some clever science. Science is almost no part. Once you've done a bit of few experiments in the lab, it's all about engineering and converting, you know, raw materials into finished goods. And so it's this perception that you can just con people into believing something works. And
the media definitely bears a lot of responsibility here, because they're the actual con merchants, it seems to me. What do you make of some of the worst excesses of the press during the initial stages of COVID? Because the idea was, we've got to convince everybody that this is deadly serious.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Well, I've got this picture of this guy in the mind's eye. He was a Sky News reporter in a white suit with a microphone in hospitals. And there was one scene I was watching, and he had this microphone up to a doctor's mouth, and the doctor looked aside at the camera, smiled, and then turned back and started saying how bad this was. Now, you know, they were going in with cameras, filming people in the hospital in ventilators. And then we found out that ventilators are more likely to kill people than help people. So it was that whole people coming from, you know, the people going to Italy and the people who were dying there in the hospitals. But they were picking hospitals where people were smokers. They had a bad health record anyway. You know, people would know more about that than me, but they were setting up in hospitals films, videos that would put the fear of God into people.
Yeah, and also they were showing film of in China of people supposedly dropping dead in the street.
Yes.
Then, I mean, there are all sorts of journalistic ethical questions about going into a hospital and filming in a ward where people may be dying. But then we also had people being prosecuted, ordinary members of the public, for going into hospitals and not actually filming specific individuals in their beds, but just showing how empty they were. Some of those were prosecuted just for being there and showing that, this hospital's almost empty.
Well, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it was all sent in. It was all sent. The censorship really has been the, you know, in my mind, the big story in this.
We know quite a lot about ivermectin now and the effectiveness of that, which was actually originally designed as an anti-parasitic drug, but it's got this serendipitous effect that it actually really does slow down the respiratory viruses and other sorts of viruses from spreading around your body. So it's an incredibly useful, brilliant drug. I know the French actually grabbed, the French government grabbed all of the supplies of ivermectin in the January before really anyone knew that that COVID was happening, and they stockpiled that and took it away so that people couldn't get it over the counter, or it was even really difficult to get it through, even if a doctor dared to prescribe some. But the ivermectin phenomenon is an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in theory, doctors should have been able to use it because a doctor, qualified doctor, can use it off-label. So ivermectin is not approved for a flu indication. You know, it's not approved for flu, and that's why only doctors who are happy enough and brave enough to use ivermectin, people like Pierre Corey in the US, could do it. But then, you know, they were closed down. I did work with Tess Laurie for a while trying to get ivermectin registered by the MHRA, because I consulted to a company in Bulgaria, animal health company, in 2012 that makes ivermectin, and very good company, very strong process. But of course, and they were starting to look at getting a license for ivermectin in flu. But again, off-label use of drugs has been around for years and years. So they should not have been stopping doctors using ivermectin if they thought it was going to be affecting. And hydroxychloroquine, I don't know too much about that, but people were saying, you know, that had, because doctors can see, you know, doctors, if they're ethical doctors, will see if a drug is working or not. And if it's not, they'll stop using it. If it is, they'll use it more. That's the way the world's supposed to work.
Well, I suppose the idea is that if there's loads of ivermectin around, no one's going to need a vaccine.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah. And then they had remdesivir, which is one of the world's most deadly drugs. And they were recommending that, and people were dying, particularly in the US. In fact, my sister-in-law was in hospital, and I don't know if you know Lois Bayliss, the lawyer. They were going to, she was going to be struck off by this SRA. My sister-in-law was going to be given remdesivir, and she did me a letter to send to the hospital to say under no circumstances should be given remdesivir. But the NHS was using it. One of the people said it was liquid gold, which, you know, idea
is... Let's just talk for a minute then about these protocols, because there were certain procedures that hospitals, pharmacists, etc., were told that they had to use during COVID. So we've heard a few examples about how wrong they were. You mentioned the ventilators too, which could actually exacerbate the problem, because it's treating something. So, for example, it's treating a respiratory illness, but actually the problem is the cytokine storm, which is going on the other side of the lungs barrier, you know, that rather than inside the lung, it's on the body's side of the lung the problem is. And so a lot of this stuff, I mean, how deliberate was that, do you think, that these protocols were actually nowhere near what any intelligent, independent-minded doctor that knew what they were doing would have imposed?
Well, we come back to Matt Hancock again, don't we? And we know the bedazlam and morphine. I forget what that's called, sort of an end-of-life protocol that appears to be have been actioned in nursing homes, etc. This isn't a strong point for me. I don't know, but the NHS, of course, is heavily involved in these gene therapies because they've been developing these drugs for rare diseases, the gene therapies. There's three networks in the UK working in the NHS developing these. They effectively, the gene modified cell therapies, being run by, it's being headed by the Cell and Gene Therapy Catapult, and the supply chain, as I say, is not feasible. It's not feasible to build a supply chain that is safe, because there's so many unknowns, with them being biologics and, you know, sensitive to temperature and all sorts of other things.
One of the things I heard was that the hospitals would only insure for the use of these official protocols. So anyone, any doctor that decides to go outside the protocol, no, this person needs a different drug, could potentially be disciplined and sacked for going outside the protocol.
Yeah, I could well imagine that. It all seems to have been engineered in a way that it forced people down a particular route that they could, and they couldn't do anything else. The whole thing was appears to be a stage management that managed. And, you know, the government, NHS, pharmaceutical companies, MH, the regulators all seem to have been part of it.
Yeah, well, can you, when we talk quite a lot about Big Pharma, Headley, but you know this world pretty well, can you just take us through some of the actual names of the companies that are Big Pharma? You know, because, I mean, we hear about things like Merck, we might hear about Glaxo and various, but who are the really, really big ones? Because we saw, I mean, one of the most shocking things I can remember hearing about during COVID was that Moderna had never actually produced anything. This was just a company that had been set up on paper. A load of money had been put into it to develop a vaccine, but they had no experience of anything at all. So who is Big Pharma?
Okay, so Big Pharma, the biggest is Johnson & Johnson. And it's interesting to see that there's a company in the US got a class action going against them for claiming that Johnson & Johnson's talc causes cancer. And that's a very active class action. Then you've got Roche in Switzerland. They're probably the second biggest. Then you've got AbbVie. You've got Sanofi. You've got, obviously, GSK. In fact, I'm just reviewing my book edits now, and I've got a slide in there for the 10 biggest pharma companies in the world. So I'm just trying to remember that. But Merck, of course, Merck was the biggest in the world. AstraZeneca, I think, is number 9. Boehringer Ingelheim, Bristol Myers Squibb. They're all multi-billion-dollar organizations. If you take Moderna, other than the people you see on the website, I don't think there's any more substance to them. They've been given some facilities by one of the big farmers, Novartis or whatever, that's been handed over to them, but they wouldn't know how to manage it anyway. And, of course, the government gave them a 10-year contract for their vaccines. And I don't know where that's gone at the moment. And, you know, the government is building them a huge R&D center in Stevenage. Stevenage is the headquarters, is the sort of central focus of Big Pharma in the UK. GSK had a massive research center there, which was turned into a research park. So all indications that, you know, Big Pharma is not making a lot of money. It's desperate. Doesn't have any products. No
market. Hence, they have to constantly try and lobby to get stuff, you know, imposed on people. How would you compare the pharmaceutical model of prescribing drugs to cure disease rather than as against the what we would probably call herd immunity, which is managing diseases as much as possible to allow the natural immune system to deal with them and actually giving that a kind of lift? We heard about things like giving vitamin D, zinc, and things like that. Actually, it's helping your body do its job rather than injecting something into you to do it for you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're called vitamins and minerals are called functional medicines. And, you know, they help the body function. But I, as I say, not to plug my next book, Transforming the Pharmaceutical Supply Chain. But I introduced a new paradigm for the industry, which is, you know, Mother Nature gave you a body. And it works for itself, you know, it's got an immune system. And the first, you know, the doctor's Hippocratic oath, do no harm, that applies first. So, you know, let the body do the work. If there needs to be a medical intervention, you know, then There's numbers of interventions you could make that don't involve some of these really, you know, hard hitting drugs. Things like, you know, I won't go into the detail of it, but so we've got to bring healthcare professionals back into drug development and repurpose some of these medicines like ivermectin. You know, the only thing that the doctors don't understand is the way the supply chain is built, what they call the chemistry, manufacturing and controls element. You know, how you build a supply chain, a physical supply chain, and how you convince the regulators that you've got a drug that is safe and effective.
Yeah, so, well, look, this is your department. So let's wind up by asking you the sort of $6 million question, or I think it used to be the $60,000 question, but under inflation it goes up a bit. which is, how do you tell, through your knowledge of the supply chain, what rules were broken during COVID to bring these things? I mean, obviously, one thing I know you're going to tell me is the testing that was done being inadequate beforehand. And we know it was all rushed. But what is it about the supply chain that's brought these mRNA vaccines, they call them, I just call them jabs, to us? Because this is your area of expertise, Hedley.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the thing is, they had, I don't know if you remember, they had this thing called a rolling review. They had a conditional authorization for these drugs, which meant they didn't go through a formal authorization. They called something called a conditional organization. So approval. So, and the conditions are listed, and I've been through the conditions. You know, for all the vaccines, there's about 10, 12 pages of them. The first is the fact they should have been made to good manufacturing practice, which clearly they couldn't have assessed because the rolling review didn't take account of the supply chain timelines. It just took account of the time to run the clinical trials. But normally, before you are allowed to run clinical trials, you have to spend about 3 years building smaller supply chains, testing them in animal models, and then eventually you've got enough data to say it's safe to start a phase 1 trial in healthy volunteers. Even then, you're not absolutely sure it's fully safe, but of course, you know, healthy volunteers, they put, you know, students in these you know, these hospital beds with Game Boy and they give them the drug, and then there's a report on that. So it takes at least 3 years to build a supply chain and know it's safe. So how could they have developed a drug in 9 months? Absolutely impossible. But, you know, this is, what they've done is they have, speeded this up by pretending there wasn't a supply chain involved in developing these vaccines. They just said we can run clinical trials. It takes about 6 to 9 months to recruit a clinical trial, do the testing, and then write the report. So even that is longer than it took to approve the injection. So I would stand up in front of any court in the world and explain exactly how this was fraudulent. I've done 6 expert witnesses statements. I've done one for Mr. State of Mississippi, one for PJH Law at the start of this, one for Lois Bayless, one for Stop the Shots in America. And their censorship is such of the legal, I think it's the legal profession. I mean, up to date, no lawyer seems to want to touch a class action on the fraud that's taking place here. But I think with Donald Trump and Robert Kennedy Jr. in place, they're going to take the lid off this. Robert Kennedy Jr. is already, you know, making noises. There's a new guy at FDA. There's a new people at the CDC, and his appointments are people who, on the face of it, I don't know them personally, but seem to have patient perspective
Well, look, this is important, isn't it? Can you just give us your take on whether you think RFK Jr. as the health secretary in the States is really going to do anything? I mean, he's certainly made a lot of noise during COVID about the evils of the pharmaceutical industry, and he himself is a lawyer that's fought these big corporations for many years, which to me does seem like one of the... I mean, I was interviewing the former MP Chris Mullin a few weeks ago, and he said the pharmaceutical industry was the first industry, even before the oil industry, to move its bases around, to move its factories around, to make the best use of... because they're multinationals... to avoid paying tax. And that was in the 1970s. These are what you might call a kind of Fourth Reich, really. They're companies that were formed mostly after World War II or rebranded or money was injected into them. And much of that money, it certainly looks now as if it was ex-Nazi money that was looted from Europe, and that these companies after World War II were much of the laundered money from Hitler's occupation of Europe was injected into some of these farms. I mean, Bayer is one of the obvious ones, but there are many others. So what do you make of RFK? And is he going to be able to deal with this kind of big pharma Fourth Reich?
Well, I started a Substack in January 2022 called Inside Pharma. And in October 2022, Robert Kennedy Jr. subscribed to it as a paid, and he's been subscribing ever since. And a couple of weeks ago, I did a Substack on Peter Marks, who was the head of FDA Biologics Division. Now, he's been approving all these vaccines, and he's been the bad egg there all along. And I explained what he'd been doing. He's been going to meetings in the UK for 4 years on MHRA technology. And he looked at that on the 14th of March. And on the 20th of March, Peter Marks was fired. Well, he resigned, but he had to resign before he was pushed.
So I mean, it's a slow process, I suppose, isn't it, to weed out all of the... these weasels all around in the, you know, US government that have managed to get in there through the pharmaceutical industry, Headley. So anyway, you mentioned your Substack. Do you want to just tell us about a couple of the recent posts on there, what sort of thing we can find?
Well, you can find FDA inspections that at facilities, FDA inspections of the Pfizer facility, Wyeth Biopharma, the one that made the first Pfizer injections, and the inspection that site had was horrible. FDA write what they call a 483 inspection report once they've done an inspection, and those inspectors go through everything with a fine-tooth comb, and they basically found the whole thing was out of control. And that's a picture that you see every facility. And FDA is the only regulatory authority that has continued to inspect facilities through COVID. All the rest of them were doing distance inspections, they call, which is about as useful as a chocolate teapot. So there's a wealth of evidence. I've got the guy who was advising Donald Trump on warp speed, Monsif Slaoui, a 30-year GSK executive. He advised Donald Trump on the warp speed injections, having spent 30 years developing vaccines in Africa. So, you know, I've got Jeremy Farrar in there, Sir Richard Sykes. You know, you couldn't find a more detailed assessment of all the bad stuff that's gone on. So
Well done, Headley, anyway, for sticking with it all. I know you've also, as well as some of your technical professional books, you've also published some writings which are more aimed at the general public. So can we finish just with if you can explain what people can get hold of to read if they're interested in the subject?
Yeah, well, if you go into Amazon, wherever you are, and put my name in, you'll see some of the books. The best one, I think, is The COVID Supply Chain, Fact Not Fiction, because I basically explain in simple terms what they should have been doing, and it's very easy to work out that they didn't do almost any of it. But I wrote that in 2023. In 2015, this is my favorite one, I wrote Find It, File It, Flog It, Farmers' Crippling Addiction and How to Solve It. And then I wrote Taming the Big Pharma Monster, speaking truth to power in 2019, I think. So they are written, easy read, you know, 2-3 hours, you go through it, and you'll know 10 does more than anyone worked in the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it'd be good to, we could share these with our doctors too, because many of them seem to just go with the flow, go with the herd, don't they? The doctors don't really check, it seems to me. They just do what they are expected to do by the pharma lobby.
Oh yeah, well this is Maggie Thatcher behind this, isn't it? You know, she effectively privatized GPs by setting up these profit centers. So GPs have got no incentive, you know, to do anything other than, you know, see patients and give them medicines and, you know, keep the practice running. And, you know, I think the whole of primary care is in complete disarray, and all the weight is falling on secondary care, and we see an A&E departments being, you know, overloaded, and it's unbelievable. But so hope that helps, Tony. Anyway,
yeah, it does, and I think the message is, the ultimate message is, we've got to start much more taking responsibility for our own healthcare. And I just wonder if, you know, if there are, you know, if you were looking for some advice which was outside the pharmaceutical lobby, whereabouts might that be?
Well, first thing I'd say is, if you're looking at, you know, natural remedies or herbal or any, you've got to be sure the supply chain is safe. You know, even if it's natural, it doesn't mean that it's been manufactured to the right standards. And that's an issue with some of the supplements, you know, some of the St. John's wort is a classic, because that can have an effect on, you know, the vessels in your brain. It can cause sort of like transient ischemic attacks and things
right,
like
so
that.
Even the natural remedies have got side effects of various sorts, haven't they?
Yes, absolutely. So, and certainly don't buy anything off the internet. Don't buy these injections for losing weight. Obviously, that's a complete con again. Just trust your body and, you know, investigate people, who offer alternative ways of working, but make sure you do your due diligence.
Yeah, in my experience, the homeopaths tend to be quite good, even if you might not believe at all in this idea that a little tiny amount of something will cure you. They just tend to take a much more independent-minded view of solving health. So can you just remind us about your whereabouts to find you, follow you, etc., Hedley?
So I've got Inside Pharma, which is... you should find me, if you Google that. I think it's, www.hedleyreese.substack.com. I've got a website, Pharmaflow Limited. If you Google that, that's first half of pharmaceuticals and then flow, limited.
What is that? FLO?
No, sir. Oh yeah, FLOW. Sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's pharma as in going with the flow. Pharma flow. And there's a lot of information. That's my consultancy, and that's been going since 2005. You can find me. I'm on X, and I'm so censored that if I tweet something, I might not get any more than 2 or 3. Likes, even though I've got 14,500 followers, so I don't quite know how that works.
Yeah, that's called shadow banning. That tells us you must be saying something true. Elon Musk has decided that he wants to shadow ban you, Hedley, with his little algorithms. He thinks he's so clever, doesn't he? Anyway, look, Hedley Reese from Wales, thanks ever so much for joining us.
You're very welcome, Tony. You take care, my friend.